guess you said it was very significant. The late 30s were very significant for an understanding of what followed in the 40s and eventually the break in 48.
Or do we confine our remarks to the communist issue?
No, not necessarily, but we can start there. Let's just start, say, with the development of hostility around 37, 38, and see where that takes us. With a view to arriving at an understanding of the split, but anything else that occurs to you, go ahead.
The IWA was founded in 1937. It was the outcome of a struggle with the Carpenters Union, in which the IWA first petitioned for equality of status within the Carpenters and Joiners. This was denied. It then appealed to John L. Lewis, head of the CIO, and were given aid in their preliminary organization by way of a loan from the CIO. I don't want to keep going. Do you want?
Well, actually, I just find it to be a conversation. You know, it needn't be anything else. You told me that they were treated as second-class citizens, you thought.
Non-beneficial members.
Mm-hmm.
They paid lower dues than carpenters did. The AFL had given jurisdiction over woodworkers to the Carpenters Union, but they were not allowed to voice or vote on the floor of the Carpenters International Convention.
My goodness. What was the discrepancy in the dues?
Anyway, a delegation went from what was then the Federation of Woodworkers went to the Miami Convention, were unsuccessful in gaining a status within the Carpenters Union, journeyed to Washington, interviewed Lewis, and got a promise of aid from Lewis, which was implemented when they met in Tacoma and in Portland that year to found the International Woodworkers of America, an industrial union. From the very start, the members of the IWA believed in the principles of industrial unionism as opposed to craft unionism. It has since remained an industrial union. From the date of its foundation, a struggle developed within the IWA as between suspected communist domination and those who were opposed to mm-hmm. communist domination. And for 5 years, until the convention of 1941, a clique headed by Harold Prochet of British Columbia ruled the International Union by various devices. They controlled conventions, mainly by setting up paper locals. They controlled the organizing staff, demanding that paid organizers of the Union should be affiliated with the Communist Party. They moved the international headquarters to Seattle, where it was almost next door to the headquarters of the Communist Party, and it was known that officers of the Union and officers of the Communist Party were in frequent consultation.
You mentioned to me before, by the way, I should mention, this is just for my own use. Nobody else will hear this, so you know, I just want to go over it at home slowly and write it up. But you did mention that that these were very sincere and able men, and you also intimated that they were not perhaps wicked and devious so much as they perhaps misconstrued what was in the best interest of the membership. Would you say that, or were they?
On economic issues, they professed to be militant, but their policies veered with those of the Communist Party. For instance, they, in those early days, they bitterly opposed the Marshall Plan. During the days of the Hitler-Stalin non-aggression pact, they advocated a no-war policy. When Hitler invaded Russia, then they promoted a no-strike policy on the part of the IWA.
They promoted a no-strike policy?
A no-strike policy, you see. An all-out war effort to support the war against Hitlerism.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
With sacrificing strike rights.
I see. It was construed, especially by the Canadian Congress of Labour, as a very patriotic move, this idea of a no-strike call and so on.
Not exactly. At a later period, they were suspended from the Canadian Labour Congress because they violated the policy of the Constitution of the Congress.
How'd they do that?
By insisting on support of the Soviet Union policy. Mm-hmm. Now, every convention up till 1941 was a scene of battles. Not only the international conventions, but the district conventions in British Columbia. Mm-hmm. British Columbia was known as District 1, the International Woodworkers of America at that time, since been changed to, in 58, to Region 1, including the four western provinces.
At this time, it was the biggest, was it not?
One of the biggest unions in British Columbia.
And also, was it not the biggest delegation to the conference, say, in Portland?
No, the district was not well enough organized. Their representation at the early convention was not very strong. Mm-hmm. But the base of communist activities was in British Columbia. And the delegates they sent down there, like Pritchett and like Nigel Morgan, were associated with the Labour Progressive Party, the political arm of the Communist Party.
What year was it then?
Not till about 40 or 41 did the British Columbia delegation show some strength in the international conventions.
Uh-huh. And it did become the largest, I believe.
It is in recent years.
Yeah. But during the war, was it not?
One of the largest. I'd have to check the records to show it was larger than. It's one of the largest, most influential districts. Nowadays, we're thinking in terms of five regions. Mm-hmm. At the present time, the membership of Region 1, which includes British Columbia, Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba, is the largest in the International Union. But in the early days, the BC District Number 1 was strictly British Columbia. At that time, the interior of the province was not as well organized as it is now.
You say there was a tremendous heated disputes both in the district and in the international convention. Was the cause of the dispute the same at the local level as well as the international level?
The IWA quickly developed a tradition of independence in its early days because of the struggle of the Carpenters Union.
Yeah.
When they joined the CIO as an industrial union, and claimed representation in woodworking operations in the Pacific Northwest states, Bill Hutchison of the Carpenters Union declared that carpenters would not touch a stick of wood produced by a CIO union.
Maybe I should just restate the question.
I'll recite some facts. How about that?
Okay, sure.
The IWA was founded in 1937. At that time, British Columbia became District 1 of the international organization. Not until 1958 was the international divided into five regions with the necessary constitutional changes. At the time of its formation, the representation at the international conventions from British Columbia was small. But the old lumber and sawmill workers, which had preceded the IWA, had been dominated by a pro-communist group. And this same group took control of District 1 and by active organization assumed control of the international organization and retained that control until 1941. This domination was protested vigorously by large sections of the membership, notably the loggers from what was then known as the Columbia River Basin District. To understand the character of the IDROA, it must be remembered that it came into being as a move of rebellion against the United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Joiners. The Carpenters and Joiners had been given jurisdiction over the woodworkers by the American Federation of Labor. They had conducted, negotiated unsatisfactory settlements in the year 1936, with the result that the Federation of Woodworkers sprang into being, but attempted to retain affiliation with the Carpenters and Joiners. In British Columbia, it is interesting to note that the pro-communist group attempted for a much longer period to retain that affiliation. In any event, prior to the 1937 first Constitutional Convention, a strong delegation representing the Federation of Woodworkers went to the International Convention of the Carpenters and Joiners in Miami, Florida, and demanded equality of status. They protested vigorously the status of beneficial membership, which denied them full voice and vote on the floor of the Carpenters Conventions. In their disappointment, they journeyed to Washington, interviewed John L. Lewis, received promises of assistance, and returned to their first conference in Tacoma with a loan of $25,000 to assist in organizing the IWA. And at that time, the name International Woodworkers of America was adopted and confirmed by a constitutional convention held later in Portland, December of the same year. The succeeding 2 years was a period of bitter strife with the carpenters contending for control of woodworking operations in the Pacific Northwest. This struggle was not so bitter in British Columbia because of frequent conferences held between the District Council in British Columbia and the Carpenters Union here, but gradually the IWA demanded and secured certification in sawmills and logging camps in British Columbia. This developed a spirit of independence. It also marked a very definite trend of opinion in favor of industrial unionism as opposed to craft unionism. Industrial unionism was better adapted to conditions in the mass production industry, such as the lumber industry. From the very first convention, the pro-communist group, headed by Harold Prochet, was fought by a large and influential section in Portland and Oregon, headed by A.F. Hartung, now the international president, who resented this domination. They resented the fact that this domination was made secure at international conventions by the creation of paper locals, by the fact that there was no genuine roll call vote in conventions, by the fact that this pro-communist group secured control of the organizational machinery and made certain that paid staff members, organizers notably, were members of the Communist Party. The anti-communists resented the removal of the office to Seattle, where it was situated almost next door to communist headquarters, and they were well aware that officers of the IWA were in close consultation with Communist Party leaders. Now, every convention, international or district convention, was the scene of battles between what are known as the white block, white blocks, and the red blocks.
Could you just tell me, when did the term white block start? I mean, would it be after the
41? Well, in the Pacific Northwest states, the white blocks were active from the start. They waged their fight and were successful in 1941 in overturning the pro-communist rule, and elected Worth Lowry as international president. And from there on, in the international union, they restored full control of the union's affairs to the membership. And that was the basis of the reverse policy. It was accomplished by constitutional amendments, which assured the membership control of the affairs of the union, which assured that there would be proper roll call votes on the basis of actual membership. They eliminated the paper locals. They established better administration of the union's funds, because previously there had been accusations of irregularities. And they took control. However, the base of the pro-communist control was in British Columbia, the British Columbia District Council, which Harold Prichette was the head. And Harold Prichette, from 41 until 48, the district council machinery and the district council came into greater strength in those years. They became better organized, had a larger treasury, and they seized this occasion to constantly attack the policies of the International Union to the discomfiture of many members in British Columbia. Now, I think it's important to say that the active pro-communists had shielded themselves behind the traditional tolerance of woodworkers for left-wing activities. A strong sentiment in support of freedom of conscience in political and religious matters prevailed. Red baiting was decidedly unpopular. The militancy professed by communist-trained leaders was accepted as genuine trade unionism by many. The majority of the woodworkers had little interest in the ideological controversies of the day. Few, very few, were actually members of the Communist Party, but many were confused by the party's propaganda network. These factors account for the fact that it took 5 years for the newly formed union to free itself from disruptive intrigue.
Now, when you say disruptive intrigue, isn't that a loading it just a bit? Would you say it was disruptive intrigue?
Well, I say it was disrupted because the strength of the union was dissipated. Attention of union members was focused too often on the controversies promoted by the Communist Party. As, for instance, over the objections of large sections of the membership, they opposed the Marshall Plan. During the non-aggression pact, the Hitler-Stalin non-aggression pact, the Communists actively promoted a no-war policy, which, after Pearl Harbor, was resented by large numbers of the American members, and certainly by Canadian members. Then, when Hitler invaded the Soviet Union, they ditched the old policies and actively promoted a no-strike policy. The agreements negotiated during that period were virtually dictated by management in the anxiety of the communists to avoid any industrial strife to impair the war effort, and that was resented by large sections of the members.
It was disruptive in a different sense then, because the organization of the union was increasing, and it was becoming a much more forceful body under its communist control. So it wasn't disruptive in the terms of organization.
It was disruptive in the sense that the introduction of political policies of that type in conventions, divided the membership, and we had this disruption of divisions, every convention, and bitter battles in every convention.
White and red blocks.
White and red blocks, you see, fighting for control. And not until 41 in the International Convention did the white bloc gain control, and they gained control by establishing in 40 convention a unity committee. And this unity committee of four brought in recommended constitutional changes that stopped and prohibited the machinations of a special clique. I contend that the machinations of a clique is always disruptive when they violate the accepted democratic traditions of an organization like the Woodworkers, who have been felt intensely democratic when the organization was first founded, and felt themselves allied with the policies of the CIO of that day, and anxious to support CIO policies, which were contested by the pro-communist group.
So you would contend that even though there were tremendous organizational gains, there could have been a lot, and a very strong union formed. It could have been a much stronger union had not...
I certainly agree. It could have been a much stronger union had they not resorted to these tactics.
Mm-hmm. So then you can't really attribute... that much ability and energy to these communist leaders, you'd attribute more the gain more to increased industrial activity due to the war.
I would say so. Now, after about 1940, the situation became so acute that a rump session was held after the Aberdeen Convention. And the international officers were charged with creating dissension by attempts to purge staff members that were not subservient to the Communist Party, and displaying rank discrimination against members not in accord with the dictates of the administration of that day. So a direct appeal was made to the CIO president, and an arrangement was made, a committee of inquiry was set up. It was comprised of Dalrymple, Chairman, J.C. Lewis, and Reed Robinson, later at the Mine Mill. Hearings were held in January and February 1941. And I read the transcript of the evidence, and it clearly disclosed that these supported the facts that I have stated.
So this led then to the changeover in 41 and the election.
Partially.
And the Constitution.
Yeah. These facts were disclosed. The IWA was in debt to the CIO for more than $50,000. It had other large outstanding debts. A fictitious membership claim of $100,000 proved to have declined to a dues-paying $19,000. Inflated or per capita tax reports to the CIO were supported by worthless promissory notes. Financial statements concealed the true facts. And later, the international trustees who probed this matter condemned these financial manipulations as wholly irresponsible. And there was arbitrary pro-communist interference with local union self-government. That annoyed members. For instance, the CIO loaned Adolf Germer, a well-known trade union leader in the United States, Pop Germer, as he was called, just recently died. And he won a number of elections, say, for instance, the very strong Weyerhaeuser operations, the Longview area, with tremendous votes. And when the Germer organizers first appeared on the scene, they were flatly denied cooperation by the local officers who favored the administration. Nothing could be done, they said, until Germer was fired. And it reached the point where the members voted to oust the financial secretary, who was not obeying their wishes, and he, displaying a gun, refused to vacate his office. It just grew to be that serious. That men are carrying clubs and guns, and Germer was protected by an armed bodyguard.
How about in BC?
Well, BC was the base.
So you mean these guns and clubs were carried?
The chapters finally refused admission to the United States. He got across for almost 2 years he ran that office as on special permits. Then he was forced to resign, but he, without reference to the membership, promoted his second in command, Orton, to be a president, and the rule continued.
Did he pack a gun off to the convention?
Well, there were some bloody struggles behind the scenes. It grew out of the similar struggles of the carpenters, because the war with the carpenters was very bitter and very bloody.
All this club carrying, was any of this done in BC, or was this just in the
States? No, because they had full control of British Columbia until 48.
Yeah.
Germans organizers penetrated British Columbia. That had an influence here, and was largely responsible for the organization of white blocs in the British Columbia local unions.
Is that right?
The largest one of these was probably in the New Westminster local. Fever belonged to that. Andy Smith works down the hall, belonging to that, and they kept challenging Pritchett's rule, and in 1948, the convention, which you have the record there, a crisis was reached, and the pro-communist groups saw that they were losing control. They didn't dare face another convention; they'd lose out, as they had done in the international scene. So they held a packed meeting of the district council in October 1948 and moved to secede from the international. They moved to seize all the funds, property, and assets of the district council and transfer them by this resolution to the ownership of the Woodworkers Industrial Union of Canada. And they moved to disaffiliate all the local unions in British Columbia from the International Union. And that, of course, that a decision of that nature without reference to the membership was, as Fever stated, was very much resented.
Well, who voted? Representatives of, you say it was passed by a packed
house? It was a packed house. The local unions, in control of the pro-communist group, dominated from by the district council, the officers, had elected delegates who carry out the will of the administration. Now,
why didn't the other unions come along and vote against it? The other locals?
Well, all the locals were represented.
They were all represented?
Oh, yes.
I see.
As far as I know, we have the proceedings.
But they made sure that the representatives were...
They had that well-organized machine. They control the election of delegates.
How would they control the election of delegates? It was not from the
members. In every local union, there were communist cells. These communist cells would meet in advance of the meeting, which elected delegates. And with carefully planned strategy, they would outwit. Perhaps the most common practice was to delay the decisions until late in the evening. Meetings would never break up till 12 or 1 o'clock. And by that time, most of the fellows had grown weary and gone home, and they got the decisions through. That was a common tactic. They were talking about that this morning in Westminster.
So now, how about in BC, is there any particular incident, say, in 42, 43, 44, or was there just a terrific turmoil within the union?
There's turmoil, but the issue was clarified at the 48 district convention.
Yeah, I realize that, but I mean, during the intervening period, was there any particular incidents which would demonstrate the turbulence within the union itself?
No, there were no violent incidents, just there's constant battle going on in the local unions.
And the white blocs growing stronger.
That's when it's in New Westminster, the white bloc would meet. They'd canvass all the members of the white bloc prior to a membership meeting. You'd be sure to attend, you see, and sure to hold them there in attendance. The meeting was over, and lay out their strategy, introduce probably innocuous resolutions just to test their strength, and then challenge the policy of the district council as dominated by the pro-communist group.
but they were never successful, that they were gradually growing in strength.
They were growing in strength.
And they were helped from...
They had occasional successes, but more often defeats.
And this was organized from people from the States, set up here.
From 41 until 48, it was organized at the headquarters of the district council here in British Columbia.
Yeah, but I say, what gave them the start, this man sending up organizers for the White Bloc.
Loaned by the CIA, Adolph Germer, yes. He was a factor. He was a well-known, trusted leader. And his organizer, he appointed the organizers as international director of organization. And he secured a special assessment to support his organization activities.
Good.
And he penetrated British Columbia and helped to build this. At the same time, the Canadian Labor Congress was interested in the situation. The BC Federation of Labor, George Holm, people of that sort were all interested in the situation and were helping. Bill Mahoney came through here on behalf of Congress, spent some time in British Columbia and assisted in coordinating the work of the White Blocs prior to this secession move in October 1948.
Was the CIO still active in helping the White Blocs to form and organize during 42, 43, 44?
Yes, the CIO responded to the appeals of the White Bloc, sent Germer in. And
personally,
they named Germer and loaned him, yep, as it were, to make him so that he could be made director of organization for the IWA.
But was he personally here?
Occasionally.
Yeah.
And he was appointing the organizers, given authority to appoint the organizers.
And so Germer's influence was in 41, 42, 43, right through. Up to the revolution.
Because by that time people became cognizant of the evidence disclosed at the official inquiry instituted by the CIO.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that was held against Pritchett.
Oh yes, yes. Now at the 48 convention the issue was clarified. A resolution was introduced.
Could you tell me, before we go into that, could you just go over the strike and the master agreement, the beginning of...
Oh, the pro-communist group conducted a strike in 1946, mm-hmm, one of the first industry-wide strikes in the history of the IWA, and which laid the foundation for industry-wide bargaining. After that strike, the employers in British Columbia agreed on a central bargaining agency. And from that time on, we began bargaining on an industry-wide basis. Not very successfully, because the taint of communism charged against the IWA was used to the disadvantage of the IWA in bargaining.
I see.
Employers would whip up propaganda that we were a Red-controlled organization.
Which is true.
Now that... remember, up until the end of the war and shortly afterwards, we were subject to the wartime regulations.
Sure.
So little could be done. 46 was the first time we could bargain freely and strike.
Yeah. Yeah.
With effect.
Yeah. PC 1.03 was still in effect.
Yeah.
In 46. That was before.
Well, thereabouts. I'm not sure of the exact dates.
Yeah. What were the conditions of the master agreement? I don't have to be too specific, but just wage increases, closed shop.
No, the union shop didn't come for some time. $2.25 a day. 36. And
this was supplemented, I take it, by cost of living bonuses during the war.
In the camps, 1942, as a result of demands upon the War Labor Boards, logging camps, Whistle Punk got $5.90 a day, Chokerman $5.90 a day, a Chaser $6.25 a day, a back rigger $5.90, a scaler $7, rigging slinger $7, head rigger $9.76, and that was about the general wages throughout.
So what they wanted was a wage increase?
In the Fraser Mills, the War Labor Board granted an increased base rate for day shift of 65 cents and night shift 70 cents a day.
Mm-hmm. That was the main point then, a wage increase, was it?
65 cents an hour, I mean.
Yeah, but that was the main condition of the master agreement, was the wage increase.
Yes, up until that time.
That was what provoked the strike of 46. Wage increase. Or would it be other things, you know?
Like 2-hour minimum work week and union security. Mm-hmm. And that was the first time they organized industry-wide strike action. And 37,000 strikers that lasted for 37 days.
Do you have the date there? Started? I can get that.
May 28th, the union went on strike for 37 days.
What did you say the wage increase was that they...
They demanded $0.25 an hour wage increase, a 40-hour week, and union security.
Yeah, and they got
Sloan appeared on the scene, and they rejected his proposals of 15 cents an hour with a 44-hour week and the irrevocable voluntary checkoff. They accepted Sloan's proposals, which gave the union 15 cents an hour, the 40-hour week, and the irrevocable checkoff, as well as the elimination of the no-strike pledge.
Hmm. They got the check off for the first time?
The irrevocable check off.
Mm-hmm. For fun.
Well, that, now at the 1948 convention, the issues centered around the dismissal by the international president of a Canadian member, a BC member, Greenall, who had been elected as international trustee. And a resolution was introduced at that convention which demanded the recall of the international president, Jim Fadling, for setting aside the international constitution in relation to the president's suspension of international trustee Jack Greenall. And in a roll call vote, they voted the results of that vote at that time to show the communist control, 17,377 yes, 4,370 no. That was in January, I think it was January 48.
Mm-hmm. Now, could you give me some idea of the breakdown of control by the White Bloc amongst the membership? There was a tremendous drive to go right to the members in the camps and persuade them by any means possible to organize and overthrow it. What would you say was the turning point where they finally did overthrow them? I mean, what was it? Was there any particular event which triggered?
This council meeting in October 1948.
Uh-huh. But
up to that time, they'd been working in their local unions.
Yeah.
Penetrating and gradually building up strength. White Bloc in the local union related to white blocs in the various plants and the various camps.
Mm-hmm.
All finding common cause and then uniting at district conventions, hoping to get control of the district organization.
And
as well as the local union organization.
So by the time this council meeting occurred, they were
nearly had control.
Yeah. And
And that forced the hand of the pro-communist group, because they saw the next year's convention, they'd lose control of the district.
Yeah. Can you repeat that story Fred told about the picture in the sun of him ripping up the charter?
Oh, that was resented. Their plot was carefully prepared in advance. It was a plot. I personal knowledge that Hal Perchett had his broadcast ready hours before this council meeting was convened. And at the council meeting, the Buttons, W-I-U-C, appeared. They'd been prepared in advance. And later, a picture appeared in the Vancouver Sun with Hal Perchett tearing up the IWA charter.
Mm-hmm.
And steps of that nature, taken without reference to the membership, offended the membership and made the work of the field men
a little easier.
Remember, too, that the Canadian Labour Congress had been on the scene before.
Uh-huh.
Remember, too, that the international officers had been saw the situation developing and been putting on radio broadcasts, distributing leaflets, trying to get the organization here on the rails in line with international policy. The minute they passed this motion of secession, the international officers were on the ground here. The White Blocs went into action to rally the membership and all the local unions. Conroy, who was Secretary of the Canadian Labour, who was then the Canadian Congress of Labour, authorized his men to take the field. The Federation helped, and a strong crew of organizers scattered across the province and met with an amazing response.
You said the BC Federation helped this.
George Holm did.
Yeah, but at that time...
The Federation was split.
I'll say, because the president at that time, I guess, was still Dan O'Brien, and the Secretary of Treasury was still Perchett.
Well, O'Brien was not a communist, but he was a fellow traveler in many respects.
Yeah, uh-huh. So the BC Federation had its president and its secretary of treasury against itself.
It was split, yes, badly split.
Uh-huh.
But there was no doubt about the Congress support. Men like Radford and so on.
Yeah, because by that time, I guess O'Brien was not with the Congress in the capacity he formerly held as regional organizer.
I'm not sure of the dates of his office.
Yeah, well,
to look up the records.
But anyway, he didn't have it.
Mm-hmm. And it was amazing how the union rallied. The provisional officers were installed. They took the ground. They got a court order the very next day freezing the funds of the IWA. Provisional offices were installed. J.S. Salisbury was district president, first vice president Lloyd Whelan, second vice president Jack Squires, now MLA for Alberni, district third vice president Gordon McKenty, mm-hmm. financial secretary Mike Sikora, trustees Lynch, Shaw, and Joe Morris. And the provisional offices pledged themselves to do four things. Call a convention at the earliest date to enable delegates from all BC locals to elect their district officers and determine district policy. Two, to assist all BC locals to transact the business of our union, overcome the attempt to split our union. Three, build up the maximum bargaining strength of our union and improve wages, hours of work, and working conditions. Four, install strict accounting of district finances and restore full democratic control by the rank and file members of our district officers. Remember, they found financial irregularities.
Yeah.
The investigation exposed juggling of the union's funds, in some instances definite misappropriation. The auditors reported that over $100,000 had not been accounted for by supporting vouchers. Large loans had been made to district officers and members of their families.
On the basis of that, I'll repeat the earlier question. Do you think that people like Perchett and so on were self-interested men? were wicked? Or do you think that they were very sincere and trying to do the best that that they could for the union?
I would not like to credit Pritchett with being evil, but he was a communist. I do know from personal knowledge that he protested this move directly to Tim Buck, head of the Communist Party in Canada, and was overruled. He thought it was an unwise move to make, and predicted that it would fail.
Which move is this?
Harold Pritchett.
Yeah, he protested which move?
The secession move.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Disaffiliation.
Yeah.
And Nigel Morgan, who later became leader of the Communist Party, was at that time editor of the BC Lumber Worker, was an international board member, and he counseled disaffiliation and won the day in the Communist Party, because behind the scenes there was a committee of communists to direct this operation.
And this disaffiliation vote was 4,000 to 17,000?
No, the vote I'm referring to there is a vote in support of a recall of the international president, Jim Fadley.
Right.
It's resolution number 31. I got it marked there.
Could you tell me the vote on disaffiliation?
We have the proceedings.
Uh-huh.
Well, I don't think it's recorded here because it was a PAC convention. After the 48 revolution, the international officers installed provisional officers.
Mm-hmm.
The local unions arranged, and they installed provisional officers in the local unions.
Yeah.
Now, men took to the field and appealed to the membership to stand by the union, and they succeeded.
I see. What was the date of the? What was the date of the meeting where it was decided to bring in the Constitution and fix up the shenanigans?
Well, I had a convention early in 1949.
Uh-huh. Well, that would be an annual convention.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the provisional office carried on. Other conventions denounced the action of the district officers in BC, mm-hmm. the International Council of the IWA, and the Canadian Congress of Labour.
Uh-huh. I can get the numbers of the strength of the of Pritchett.
So they took provisional officers. For instance, the Canadian Congress of Labour made room in their offices for the Vancouver local, you see. The new Westminster local was in good shape. The White Bloc by that time had gained control and took over the offices of New Westminster. And then began a long battle in the courts to recover the assets, property, and records of the union. We never got the records. We never got all the equipment.
The records were destroyed.
But we did recover the union's boat, which was hidden up in an inlet up the coast, the Larder's Navy.
They did
get the bulk of the strike fund back.
Yeah. They had two boats, though, didn't they?
Well, the Laura Wayne wasn't in active commission, I don't think. It was the Larder's Navy. One boat. One main boat. The sheriff seized that, and the court held everything frozen until it was decided by court decision to have those.
Could you just
in that scrapbook?
Good.
Decision of the court.
Could you just go through, say, the year 1949, and just explain how the IWA regained its lost strength and brought back.
Regained its strength very slowly in 1949, and interesting to note they made no particular demands at you, and they didn't make any substantial progress in the negotiations because of the weakness, you see. Some of the logging camps remained in control of the WIUC. The WIUC had a fairly good organization for a while in the southern interior of British Columbia. And there was that uncertainty about their work. It made it very difficult to rebuild. It took a lot of work in the organizers in the field to break. To remember, they had no records,
yeah,
no property, no office equipment. They started building the union from the ground up. So 1949 was a year of rebuilding. The present in 1950, that they began to show some strength. In 1952, they had their next industry-wide strike.
Mm-hmm. What was? Could you go to the fate of Pritchett during those years, 49, 50, 51?
Well. For some months, he attempted to conduct the business of the WIUC.
He was brought to trial.
Brought to trial by the International Convention and barred from membership, expelled from membership in the IWA by order of the International Convention.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, he returned to the industry to work in the industry. Although he cannot hold membership in the IWA, he's allowed to work as a, he was allowed to work for years as a shingle weaver, shingle sawyer.
I see.
One of our certified plants. They just didn't interfere with him, but they wouldn't allow him in the union, nor any of his colleagues can hold office or membership in the union.
Uh-huh.
One of them has been reinstated, I understand, since, because he redeemed himself.
How long did Pritchett work as?
I understand he's still working as a shingle sawyer.
Is that right?
I'm told that. Some new Westminster plant.
Yeah. How about the...
Occasionally you see his name in the news in connection with some Communist Front activity.
His son is very active.
His son is very active, a very able man, the longshoreman.
Uh-huh. Communist?
I don't know. I don't think so.
What was the fate of his breakaway union? It gradually lost more and more members to the IWA.
It held some membership in the logging camps for some time,
uh-huh,
about a year, and then it finally disappeared. Finally, the appearance of a Wooey button, we call them Wooeys, on the job was greeted with derision, and they took them down. But they retained some units in southern interior for several years. And we had trouble with them in the strike we had in there in 58, 59.
Well, now, how long did it take to get them out of the camps? Till about...
Oh, they were pretty well eradicated by the in a year.
In a year? I see. And then, but they maintained themselves very strong in this...
They had units here and there. Uh-huh. And they had some camps.
Till about... Well, they gave you some trouble in 58.
I have here the Iron River incident.
Yeah. That was a big fight.
That was violent.
And so O'Brien resigned from the BC Federation as a result of...
Reading from the Lumber Worker of November the 15th, 1948,
mm-hmm,
it says, "Smooth-tongued Danny O'Brien, apologist for Pritchett and his gang in the WIUC, has lost his job as president of the BC Federation of Labor, CCL. O'Brien is the man who, in his own words, has been sitting on the fence, sitting with the saboteurs who tried to wreck the IWA. And goes on to say, O'Brien's the man who was chairman of the rump meeting in New Westminster the night of October the 3rd. when Pouchet and company held a packed meeting of alleged 1-357 members to try and swing them out of the IWA. They failed miserably. O'Brien's the man who doesn't condone but doesn't condemn the trade union busting tactics for Pouchet and his gang. So
they failed, but at that meeting, didn't they?
His resignation was forced on him at the Executive Council meeting of the Federation. A resolution introduced by George Holmes, Secretary Treasurer, read that the BC Federation of Labor's Executive Council endorses the action of the Secretary Treasurer supporting the IWA and pledges its support to the IWA in their battle to organize the woodworkers and lumber workers of British Columbia. O'Brien apparently could not stomach that resolution. We know why. The resolution was passed by 6-5 votes. O'Brien tendered his resignation and was accepted by 6-4. W. Stewart, first vice president, becomes president. J. S. Stu Alsbury moves up to first vice president of the Federation.
Form another Congress.
Mine mill, fishermen, and so on.
I see, and join up with the Pouchet's Union. But it didn't materialize. What was the failure of it to materialize? Lack of sympathy with the other unions, or was it just because they couldn't?
Lack of membership support.
In the IWA?
Oh, yeah.
If they had got the membership support, say...
Once the IWA regained its strength, it outmatched the WIAC in negotiating agreements.
Sure, but supposing now, hypothetically, that the Pouchet's Union had been successful in swaying the membership of the IWA into his union, do you think those other unions would have gone along with them to set up a new Congress? Mine mill, fishermen.
I don't think they're in a position to do it successfully. Mine mill's had its struggle and its membership's been declining. I don't think the United Fishermen would have, they're not disposed to war with the lumber workers. And in any way, the number of communists, the fishermen's very small.
Yeah, sure.
It's really a good union, a very democratic union.
Yeah. I mean, they're not ready to quarrel with the loggers, but supposing that the loggers had gone with Pouchet, they wouldn't be quarreling with them if they joined them and set up a new Congress. Do you think there would be...
It never got off the ground, that move.
Yeah, well, that's
four western provinces. In this province, we have under one, in one house, one union, the loggers, the workers in the plywood plants, all of them, the workers in all the sawmills, and nearly all the shingle mills, with but one or two exceptions, which are in the old shingle weavers union affiliated with the carpenters. The situation is different down across the line. The lumber and sawmill workers have about an equal number of certifications as the IWA and the sawmills, three of the loggers mainly. But here is the problem of the IWA today, to keep all these sections together in one bargaining agency.
Yeah. Very fine. I think we've covered it.